This is a Village Soundcast Network original production.
Hello, and welcome to Lends Me Your Ears, the film podcast where we see something new in cinemas or on streaming services and connect and compare it to older films by the same filmmaker or in the same genre. Sometimes we give love to the work of an actor or a screenwriter. My name's Karsten Knox. I'm a film writer and critic. I'm the host of The Knox Office on CBC Information Morning. And my blog is called Flaw in the Iris. It can be found at halifaxbloggers.ca.
And my name is Stephen Cook, and I'm a freelance writer and soon-to-be instructor and all-around film enthusiast here in Halifax.
And on today's episode of Lends Me Your Ears, we are taking an entirely different approach to our podcast. We've got some news for you folks. Please stay tuned. We're going to talk about movies as we always do, but we got a few other things to say. It's going to be a Senior Pants Ramshackle edition of this podcast number, what are we at now, Stephen?
172.
Number 172 coming at you. Lends Me Your Ears.
Well, welcome back to Lends Me Your Ears as we start this show that is it's going to be a bit of a grab bag, and we have a bit of personal news for the listeners about the show and about what's happening with us in the next little while, and I think maybe Karsten, you could kick that off with some interesting movie-related duties that you will be taking on.
Yeah, well, I have been, I've said many times on this podcast, I have been working and volunteering at a local cinema series, Carbon Arc Cinema. And let's just say I am going to be more officially involved with that organization going forward, and, you know, helping them work more, organizing events and certainly the screenings going forward. So all of which to say is, that's going to be taking up more of my time. Of course, I've got the column I do on CBC Radio talking about film, and the Knox Office. I got my blog. I've gotten back into TIFF. Stephen, I don't even know if I mentioned you to this team. Yeah, I'm going back to Toronto. I was just there for like a summer vacation in Ontario the last couple of weeks, but I'm going back in September to cover the film festival again, as I did last year. We spoke about this on the podcast. You know, yes. This is a great opportunity. I'm so happy to be doing it. It's going to be a little different this year, what with the actors not being there. Be interesting to see how it changes as a result. But of course, I'm just there to see the movies. Whether the actors show up to promote them or not is not really my problem.
Well, I think some independent productions will probably see some significant people turn out, especially if they're also serving the production role.
Yeah, well, for sure. And certainly the directors will all be there, and the producers and that kind of thing. So, you know, it'll be cool. All of which to say, what with the, you know, more responsibility at Carbon Arc, Stephen, you have some changes as well to talk about. But this looks to be the final episode of Lends Me Your Ears.
Yes, very sadly, things have been kind of in flux with me for a while. I left my former job at the Chronicle Herald and the Saltwire Network at the end of last year, and I've been kind of floating around doing a few things here and a few things there. Did a bit of radio, did some writing. I've got a new column, believe it or not, that is for a paper in Cape Breton.
Huh, I didn't know about that, Stephen.
Well, there you go. I'm writing a weekly sort of entertainment, what's going on kind of thing for the reporter out of Port Hawkesbury.
Oh, that's amazing. And congratulations.
I've been doing it for a month or so, and it's been a lot of fun. Just keeping people in that area apprised of what's happening generally between between Pictou County and Sydney, basically.
Okay.
If you live in Port Hawkesbury, you're kind of equidistant between those places, and there's a lot of amazing entertainment happening, you know, within an hour. I mean, it's great if it's happening in Port Hawkesbury, and it will be certainly when Celtic Colors gets up and running in October, but there's also things happening in Guysborough and Anaganish, and you have to travel a little further for your fun, I guess, when you live in Port Hawkesbury. But
Is this stuff available online, or is it just in the paper that gets printed?
I think at the moment it's print only. They do have a website, but I'm not been able to find my column in the website. So I think they're saving it as kind of like a paper print exclusive, but I'm working on getting that up online as well. But it's been fun. Some of it's involved doing some interviews. I'll probably be doing some stuff around Music Week with some of the local nominees from the area. There's lots of people from, say, Anaganish and Mavu and Inverness County and so on that are nominated for Music Nova Scotia Awards. So I'm going to be doing some stuff on that, I hope, and we'll see what else happens. You know, maybe even talking about some things that are in say the Atlantic Film Festival that's coming up in September. So it's got a whole bunch of possibilities. They really like what I do and want me to do more of it. It's just great to have my hand in the writing game.
Yeah, absolutely. That's good news.
On top of that, I'm also going to be part of the faculty at King's College, University of King's College, here on the Dalhousie campus at the School of Journalism, where I graduated in 19... No, I graduated from there in 1989 with the Bachelor of Journalism Honors degree, and I've been putting it to good work ever since, a good use, but... they've asked me to come and join their Foundations of Journalism program, which is for the kind of the 1 years, the first years, just the basics of writing and writing news stories and doing interviews and writing features and that kind of thing. So I'm part of a kind of a revolving cast of lecturers and also hosting one of the tutorials. So that should be interesting. It's for both journalism students and those that are taking the course as an elective. So it's my first time being on that side of the academic fence, and we'll see what that brings.
Yeah, well, that's exciting too. See, so dear listener, if you have been listening to us regularly, either on CKDU, where this show is broadcast every second week on a Tuesday, or through our podcast, I just want to make sure I say this, but in case as we ramble on in our final episode here, I neglect to thank you so much for listening. You know, I know a handful of names of people who listened regularly to Lends Me Your Ears, and it has been. You know, it's great to hear from people who do listen to it and enjoy it. And we've been at it since I think May 2015. Is that right?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so we've been at it a good length of time, hopefully to create a few regular listeners. And if you're out there and haven't listened to us regularly ramble on about film, thank you. And I also want to say thank you to you, Stephen, for you handle a lot of the technical sides of things in terms of sending, you know, the digital files to our producers at the Village Soundcast Network. And it's been great talking about movies and great watching all these movies. My feeling is that, you know, that we've had a lot of fun.
And
we've also kind of accomplished something here, which is what we set out to do, which is to watch a lot of movies. I mean, I'll say this, speak for myself. I wanted to see a lot of movies that I wouldn't otherwise see, you know. Give me a deadline, give me something to put out in the world, and that helps me a lot. Otherwise, you know, I'm likely to get distracted. And so knowing that we had to show up and talk coherently about film meant that I would watch movies that I would go back in time and see all these movies I wouldn't otherwise watch and discuss them with you. It's been a huge pleasure. So thank you.
Well, same here. And certainly it's been a treat. You know, being kept on my toes about some of the films that are being released in other parts of the world, things that interest both of us that we may not have otherwise caught up with if we weren't trying to come up with a topic for each new show and trying to find new corners of the world, cinematic world, to explore. I'm really proud of the show we did on Iranian film. We did a great show on Danish films, both past and present, I really like those kind of deep dives into those kind of cinematic legacies. And I like the scattershot things where we try to pick a bunch of varied films on a similar topic, for example, but also kind of delving into one kind of cinematic universe is a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, for sure. And you know, we've done, we did episodes on Roger Ebert's favorite films, which I mean, I feel like we need to acknowledge Roger once again, who's kind of a lodestar for both of us to some degree in terms of like the critical
world. Sure.
And he's published many books where he's talked about his favorite films, and we've just gone to those lists and like his best movies and chosen ones that we hadn't seen. Those were fun. Maybe my favorite episode was the one we did. It was pretty early on about spy movies.
Yes.
Partly because we didn't have the limits of just we set this to be an hour because it suited, you know, broadcast. But in recent years, but originally we were a little more loosey-goosey with the length of the thing.
Yes,
and that one we may have watched like 15 or 20 movies, and then we talked about it for like an hour and a half. Our spy movie, I think it's in the teens. I can't remember exactly when, but that was hugely satisfying. I mean, obviously, because I'm a big spy movie fan.
Oh, me too.
You know, so that one, I mean, we've done a lot of movies about detectives, and about crime dramas, and we've done a lot of science fiction. I think if you had to look back on the entire genre aspect of this podcast, spy movies, sci-fi, and crime dramas will probably be the ones that come up the most.
Oh, for sure. And there was more than one film noir episode. We were trying to get into kind of a noir-vember tradition of tackling a bunch of film noirs or neo-noirs. It's an interesting distinction between the modern films, going back to, say, the early 70s that adapted some of the stylistic touches of film noir, but telling them in a new and fresh way. And I always like it when a filmmaker can incorporate that into their work even now. I mean, even the last Blade Runner had some of those elements in there.
Sure.
As well, in a nod to the original, but also, giving a fresh spin on the whole sci-fi film noir melange there. And, I enjoyed, looking at films from China and Japan. Anytime we got to delve into that area, one of my favorite filmmaking, not genres, but universes, I guess. But also tackling, the Marvel universe or DC.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I'm not a film snob. I enjoy Marvel movies, and I used to enjoy DC comic-related movies. I hear the Blue Beetle's not bad.
I actually saw it last week.
You saw it?
Yeah. Well, we can talk about this later. Let's talk about we'll save what we've been watching lately for later in our show.
We did say this was going to be a wrap.
Yes. So I'll make a note to bring that up.
I've not been yes.
So there's that. Of course, we did films about queer LGBTQ plus filmmakers. We did. I did a fascinating episode on indigenous filmmakers. We did films from Ireland pretty early on in our list. Whatever kind of grabbed us. Our plan generally is to look at what's opening in cinemas or in streaming, usually in cinemas, and figure out, what could we do? How could we springboard off of this new film? And that's kind of been our approach. And then we compare notes and see if we're both interested in it. And that was that's just kind of how we did it. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, that was the trick, is to, as we say off the top of the show, to take something that's new in theaters or, as we went along progressively more on streaming services, as fewer things started coming out to theaters, or, they might play at Carbon Arc, but of course the timing of things and when the show airs and that kind of thing made it difficult to include Carbon Arc titles, ahead of time very often, especially because, you might have had a chance to see a screener, but I probably didn't. So, that was the challenge, to try and pick a film that people could see while they're actually listening to the show, to actually something that's in theaters that they can get a hold of or see on the streaming service, and then try and seek out some of these films that tangentially, or maybe not so tangentially, connect to them in a way, either through the director or star. We did a behind the scenes kind of show where we looked at different creatives behind the camera and look at their contributions, based on stuff that's new in theaters, and then look at some of the things they did, that they may not have gotten the kind of acclaim for. I can't remember exactly who we talked about, but
costume
design.
We went to, because we'd seen Black Widow, and we'd already done a fair amount of Marvel stuff. So it's like, how do we recognize this film? Of course, we spy movies, we've done that, and it was, let's look at what the creatives in the various technical departments have been doing. Of course, a lot of them had previous experience in Marvel Studios, but a few of them had done other work too, and so that was that was really cool.
Anytime we looked at the work of a cinematographer, was always a treat, just to see how the camera people, the lighting people, have worked on other people's films, or sometimes they work exclusively with one director, or most notably with one director. You think of like Sven Nykvist and Ingmar Bergman, for example, although he also did great work with Woody Allen and many others. But it's, just getting into the nuts and bolts of filmmaking every couple of weeks is just such a treat to do. And, I'm probably still going to watch as many films as I ever have. My Letterboxd account is kind of going overtime, generally like in the last couple of days, I've probably seen like 3 films, and trying to check off a bunch of the things I've recorded off TCM on my DVR to try and clean up the DVR before it runs out of memory. you know, it's that part probably is going to change for me, even though sometimes I had to actively, you know, okay, it's Saturday and I usually wake up around 6, so I can probably get in like 3 movies before noon.
Kind of thing. See, I envy you. You're being a morning person.
Yeah,
that cannot do it. I mean, I will watch movies late into the night, but even well these days, given that I have to hold down a job, you know, at regular hours, after about 1 o'clock, I start to fade. 1 a.m. That is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can't get up that early and be coherent and retain much.
Yeah.
So yeah, but I, you know, 3 movies in a day is possible as long as I've got nothing else on my plate.
Well, last night I actually watched a movie after 10 o'clock for the first time in I don't know how long. Yeah. And it was Bachelor in Paradise with Bob Hope and Lana Turner.
Wow.
Yeah. I not recommended. I mean, I stayed awake.
Yeah.
I didn't doze off during the movie or anything like that, but and I don't think it's a very good movie. Oddly enough, directed by Jack Arnold, who made like The Incredible Shrinking Man, made all these great 50s science fiction classics. And here he's making this weird suburban sex comedy that has dated not terribly well,
mm-hmm.
Which is part of why I enjoyed it. I mean, I think the reason I enjoyed it was for all the wrong reasons.
And this is where you and I sometimes don't see eye.
Exactly. Right? There's a lot of dross that I'm willing to watch. And, you know, as a kind of a cultural experiment. I mean, this is a film about like a single, it's called Bachelor in Paradise. He plays a single writer with a reputation for writing these rather ribald exposés of society or whatever. And he moves into like a suburban, modern suburban neighborhood. And of course, the wives all go nuts, you know, looking for pointers on how to spruce up their marriages from him. And the husbands all get irate and try to have them kicked out of the community. And it's sort of an interesting idea. Bob Hope kind of sleepwalks through the movie. And, you know, anything past 1960 is kind of pretty much a given that he's just not going to be on his game in any of those kind of movies. And he just kind of coasts. And that was certainly the case here. But I did like that kind of, you know, 60s society trapped in amber feel of
right.
the film.
So. It probably would have just annoyed me.
Yeah, exactly. And it would probably annoy most viewers. But that, you know, if there's an aspect of a film that portray, you know, has a maybe historical kind of aspect to it, then I'm certainly going to enjoy it. I mean, like there's a scene where they're in a supermarket and it's just great watching all the characters, you know, in a 1960s supermarket and, mm-hmm. and widescreen and seeing all the brand names on the shelves. I mean, it's just all the background stuff is what was interesting about it, not what was happening in front of us.
Sure, sure. Yeah, it's funny, you know, it's like watching films on Lends Me Your Ears. I was trying to think about the ones that I enjoyed the most in terms of those deep dives into the past. Certainly Bergman was a filmmaker yeah. who I hadn't seen enough of, and now I've seen many more of. You know, Kurosawa, Powell and Pressburger, Hitchcock. Like these are the filmmakers, the great filmmakers yes, of the past, who thanks to Lends Me Your Ears, I can at least say I've seen a few and have a better sense of what they're all about. Maybe the biggest surprise for me that I didn't expect and absolutely loved was when we did Edgar Wright and Last Night in Soho.
Yeah.
And we went back and he had published a list of movies that he felt were directly inspiring his film from mostly 50s and mostly 60s British cinema. And almost every single movie there I loved. It was incredible how good they were and how much I just connected with them. It was a blast, whether they're horror or whether they're comedy or some kind of mix of like kitchen sink drama, all of that stuff was terrific. So yeah, that was a huge pleasure.
Which is great, because I remember you having not the greatest reaction to Hammer horror movies for the most part.
For the most part, it's true. I mean, I liked a few of them. I mean, The Devil Rides Out has become one of my favorites.
That is certainly the peak of their output, I think.
Yeah.
And a great Christopher Lee performance. But also, you know, a really solid, cohesive story that makes sense for the most part, you know, provided it's about sort of demonic intervention and everything, but it was kind of ahead of its time in a lot of ways, and it was based on a great novel, which is not always the case with Hammer films. They're usually from these kind of hastily written scripts that probably could have used another pass, but in that case, that's one of the examples where everything kind of clicks. And if you only see one Hammer movie, it should probably be the first Dracula film. Sure. Was really, sure. But after that, watch The Devil Rides Out.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, was there anything that really surprised you, Steve?
I really enjoyed the show on Danish film, you know, because mm-hmm. I didn't know what to expect. You know, it's always interesting discovering a country's cinema for the first time, you know, in a broader sense. You know, I knew a couple of filmmakers. I knew the drier, the older classic sort of more artsy early Danish film. And I certainly knew stuff like Von Trier. But there was a whole other world of sort of popular films and dramas and kitchen sink kind of things that, normally I probably wouldn't have tried to seek out and really, really, really enjoy it. But I've always enjoyed that, you know, like getting into Korean cinema in a big way, you know, many years ago. And then that's an ongoing thing because that filmmaking community is just getting even more and more popular as time goes by. It's especially given the success of Parasite. And then some of those older films are becoming more readily available. For a long time, you just couldn't see any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And thanks for on many different levels, you can access more of it. And there's a lot more Korean television.
streaming services.
They seem to be, and it's finding an audience in North America. You know, I watched Extraordinary Attorney Woo, a great series about a young woman lawyer who's on the autism spectrum, and it's utterly delightful. It's a little problematic. Some people are concerned about the depiction of a woman on the spectrum in the way that the show does, but then some people have said it's great to have the representation and that they'd rather see it than not see it. So, I think it's over the course of the series, I think it's handled pretty well. So, again, that's part of this whole other universe that is unfolding thanks to streaming, even though we're finding that things are disappearing from streaming at an alarming rate as well, and not as much really great old stuff is showing up as we'd like.
The large print giveth and the small print taketh away.
Exactly.
As Tom Waits said. I agree. And I mean, in my life, Carbon Arc has been also one of those places where I've been able to expose myself to a lot more international cinema that I would have not seen likely otherwise. But, that and streaming, as you say, and this podcast, all of which has been kind of like feeding me, making me fat with cinema love and passion.
Well, let's take a break here, and then we'll talk a little bit more about our cinematic summers.
So on Lends Me Your Ears Day, our rambling final episode, I'm putting a little like parenthetical question mark, just in case maybe someday down the road we decide to do this again. For now, certainly this looks like it's going to be it. We want to talk
about
the foreseeable future. Let's talk about what we've been watching in cinemas. And it was funny because when we last talked about what to do after, we had a little bit of a break and I went away and you went to the States for a festival escape, which I definitely want to hear about.
Yes.
We thought, Barbenheimer, those are the movies of the Barbie and Oppenheimer are the movies of the summer. There is no doubt. Both critically and at the box office, they are the movies everyone's been talking about. They're the movies everybody's want to go see. So what are we going to do? So, Stephen, you had the excellent idea of for an episode that I guess won't happen, of doing an Atomic Age episode. But before we get to some of the ideas of films that you might suggest we watch, and listeners can go ahead and watch them anyway if they're so inclined. What did you make of the two movies that have so grabbed people's attention?
Well, I love them both. I didn't go see them in one day. I spread them out over a couple of days. And I made sure I saw Oppenheimer and IMAX, of course. Although, the theaters were selling out days in advance. So when I went, I bought my tickets 2 days beforehand. I still had to sit in the lower section of the IMAX theater.
Yeah, that's tough.
It wasn't too bad. It was the back row of the lower section, and I could the seats reclined. So I wasn't. I didn't come out with a permanent crick neck after the screen. But I enjoyed both of them a lot. I mean, obviously Barbie is right up my alley as a pop culture kitsch connoisseur. It seemed to be hitting a lot of my, a lot of my buttons in terms of the things that I enjoy, and the fact that it was able to kind of salute and satirize at the same time, you know, in a way that I haven't seen in a movie in a really long time. I felt that it did a great job at even going into some of the history of Barbie, you know, that when Rhea Perlman shows up as Ruth Handler, I got a little verklempt to the fact that they're actually going to have someone playing Ruth Handler who created Barbie, you know, or basically took the idea from a German doll anyway, and then, you know, made it the All-American Girl Next Door as she was originally conceived. And I thought, okay, well, they really know what they're doing with this character. I mean, the only misstep I think was maybe Will Ferrell shouldn't have been in there. I think maybe it might be a better film if you kind of either, you know, replaced him with somebody else, or because he, as has been pointed out by more than one review, he's basically just playing the same character he played in the Lego movie kind of thing.
Right.
And I feel like he was a bit of a fly in the ointment when it came to Barbie. But for the most part, Margot Robbie's performance was incredible. Ryan Gosling was outstanding as Ken. I hadn't seen him do comedy in a while. I mean, I know he has that in his DNA, even going back to his Disney days. But, certainly haven't seen him do that kind of thing in a long time. And he committed. Boy, did he commit.
Boy, did he ever.
Yeah. And Michael Cera as Alan. You know, like, yeah. And me actually remembering the doll of Alan, the fact that, you know, his inclusion and his relationship with Midge, who was the pregnant doll, which caused a huge storm at the time that she first appeared. I mean, just all that stuff really, really tickled my funny bone, but it also, you know, I think it gave some of these younger viewers some food for thought, you know, because they're going to return to this movie and watch it over and over again. And hopefully some of those more important messages about feminism and you know, being yourself and all that will stick. We'll find some food for
thought. No, lines. I absolutely agree on that front. I mean, I think I remember walking out of Barbie feeling slightly disappointed. But it's a film that I've talked about so much since then. Even by the next day, I was thinking about it. And I guess I had to sort of prepare because I was talking about it on my column on CBC. I did the Barbenheimer thing. I saw Barbie in the afternoon on that Thursday that it opened, and I watched Oppenheimer directly following, in IMAX, which was actually the right way to, the right order to see those films. Because after Oppenheimer, I had no mental space for anything, not even Barbie. I don't think I could.
That would have been too much.
It was so intense. It just kind of wiped me out. But I guess I felt like there was something a bit heavy-handed about it, something a little bit obvious about it. But then, you know, after the more I thought about Barbie, the more I was like, geez, you know, this is a movie. It's a, you know, hour and 45 minute the toy commercial, but it is quite subversive. A and B, I mean, this is a movie that's being watched by a younger audience, boys and girls, who, you know, I can just try to imagine the Midwest of the United States, people seeing this again and again, and how the messages are being received. And I thought, well, damn, you know, this is, it's the fact that it has become this zeitgeist picture that everyone has to see, that it's this enormous success. Far, far beyond, I think, what the producers must have imagined.
I think so.
Just goes to show you that it has caught on in a way that is pretty amazing. And, you know, more credit, all the reasons that you liked it, I liked it too. It just took me kind of a while for it to sink in and for me to kind of appreciate it. You know, I didn't mind Will Ferrell for the most part, even though I agree he's pretty much playing a version of his Lego movie character. I thought it was, you know, Ryan Gosling just wowed me. He was so funny. And he has that talent. Of course, I remember him from the thing that always makes me laugh when I think about it is the Saturday Night Live short film that he made where he's so upset about papyrus being used in Avatar, I think so.
Yeah,
and that is so funny. Every time I think about it, and he really committed to that too. Yeah, he's amazing in it. But yes, Margot Robbie for sure, you know, full marks to her for going for it and doing this thing. And everyone in it, the casting is superb. The stuff they're talking about, I just love that people are still discussing it. They're still discussing what the ideas in the movie. And really, whatever a zeitgeist movie is, I'm always interested in why it's a zeitgeist movie. Having said that, I haven't seen The Sound of Freedom yet, which I know is also a different kind of zeitgeist movie. I might wait for it to show up on a streaming service, however, but because I've heard some of the criticisms and they do make me, they make my skin crawl just a little bit.
I have a little tolerance for Jim Caviezel, but I feel like at some point I probably should see it.
To have a sense of what's actually going on there. And so I'm sure I will at some point, but anyway, all of which to say is though I'm pleased as punch that Barbie has caught on, and also for what it says about the film industry, right? You know, I've seen a lot of film Twitter or film X, whatever the hell they're calling it now, conversations around Barbie and what Hollywood is likely to learn from its huge success, and unfortunately, it's probably that. Oh, we need to make more movies about toys rather than, oh, we need to make more movies where women are in charge of the storytelling and are focused the story on women, which I think is really what the takeaway should be.
Yeah, I was getting a kick out of how many people were just, you know, the whole sort of Ben Shapiro kind of rant take on things that the movie is anti-men. And it's like, well, no, it's anti-stupid men. You know, or anti-Brutish men. It's about how, you know, people have been fed a line by mass media about how, you know, about gender roles and how you're supposed to behave and you know, the wall that should have been torn down between men and women long ago is just being even more reinforced by reality television and various other forms of media. And you know, this film kind of just puts a foot right up that idea's butt, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you know, that's what's so great about it.
That, yeah.
You know, it's and besides, you know, movies have been so anti-women for so long. It's like, even if it is anti-man, which I don't think it is, so what?
Yeah, we can handle it.
Yeah. That's exactly it.
I mean, I think the message there is inequality hurts everybody.
Yes.
So the less there is of it, the better. And I think that is that's a great message to be out there in a movie that everyone seems to love. I mean, except for those small percentage of people who clearly don't. So I'm looking forward to seeing that again at some point. Oppenheimer, I will certainly see again, but I am going to wait for it to show up on another platform. I certainly don't need to see it in IMAX again. I mean, I really enjoyed the film, but it is, you know, that super intense score where it's coming at you. I mean, I described it as an opera. It is operatic.
Very much so, yeah. It's just the pulse-pounding nature of it, like right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's a three-hour movie of mostly people talking, and yet somehow the pacing of it is relentless.
Yeah.
It's like, and then right in the first few minutes, like, how is he doing this? Like, my heart is already racing, and they're just walking down corridors and talking.
Mm-hmm.
And getting away from some of the musical cliches that had already infiltrated previous films was a treat, but that just kind of the pounding score and that kind of almost Russ Meyer type editing where no shot is held for too long and it's the way the film just kind of works on your subconscious is pretty devious, but I mean the story is so compelling, you know, you kind of just kind of go along for the ride after a
while. Yeah, it's fascinating, right? Because really, a World War II biopic about, J. Robert Oppenheimer could have been so conventional and so plodding, and it is anything but that. And that's due to the filmmaking, you know, prowess that Nolan has got. And you know, I don't love all of it. I think some of that is kind of heavy-handed and it is a bit much, and especially in the IMAX theater where, you know, being pummeled for 3 hours is a lot. But I don't think I liked Oppenheimer as much as I liked Dunkirk, which just I also saw in IMAX and it totally floored me for just its originality of its storytelling, the way he told the story, as much as what the story is about.
And Dunkirk was even better the second time around.
And so maybe Oppenheimer will be too, but I will see it at a place, you know, maybe on a small screen Maybe I'll go see it again. It's still in cinemas. Maybe I'll go see it on a regular side, regular screen, you know, at Park Lane or something like that, rather than IMAX, and see what I get from the film that maybe I didn't quite get because of the overwhelming audiovisual intensity of it. But yeah, I mean, you know, otherwise, it sounds like I'm criticizing the film. I really enjoyed it. It is remarkably well cast and extraordinarily well told, and just like that intense feeling of doom that the film gives through the course of its sort of running time I think I've already said this, but it's visceral. It's visceral.
Yeah. It's just amazing who shows up for like one scene or two scenes here and there. James Urbaniak shows up as a very confused looking scientist who's just managed to smuggle himself out of Europe, and he's a friend of Einstein's, and he's just there for a moment and he's gone. And but it's all, you know, it's all part of the formula, as it were. And you know, I've seen the more kind of routine versions of this story, certainly Fat Man and Little Boy with Paul Newman playing the general that Matt Damon plays, and I can't remember the name of the guy who played Oppenheimer. It's escapes me at the moment, but it was all right, but it was a fairly by the book kind of historical.
I watched the trailer of it because that was one of the ones you'd suggested as maybe Atomic Age.
Yeah, I do want to revisit it. I saw it in the theaters, and you know, I remember thinking the best thing about it was the Ennio Morricone score.
But the trailer makes it look pretty hokey.
Yeah, that's probably how it's going to appear, especially if I watch it after the fact. But I do want to return to it. There's also a very good, I think it was on PBS, like two-part, TV movie with Sam Waterston playing Oppenheimer. And I remember that was sort of my first exposure to the story. And it goes more, it had a lot more detail about the Manhattan Project, which is just kind of touched on here, like the original part of the Manhattan Project, which just kind of gets lightly mentioned before they move on to New Mexico. But, you know, I think that's a little heavier on the fact, whereas this is a lot more phantasmagorical and as you say, operatic.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And for a second there, I thought Rami Malek wasn't going to have a line. Like the Oscar-winning actor, Rami Malek, shows up in a small supporting role and doesn't say anything at first. And then he disappears. I was like, oh, right, maybe that's all we get of him. But later he gets to have a line or two because he reappears later in the movie. But I'm still like, wow, okay. I guess that just says how much people want to work with Christopher Nolan. Like that's his status in Hollywood.
Oh, for sure. Like, I mean, I think, you know, him and maybe Fincher are like the two directors.
Yeah, Tarantino.
But of course, he claims to be winding down. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think in Tarantino's case, it's more that, you know, he picks who he wants to do his thing, whereas, you know, people kind of want to work with, you know. If you're not in the right camp, I don't think Tarantino's an option. But Fincher and Nolan seemed to cast wider nets with what they're doing. So.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a real pleasure to have a movie like that be, again, such an event movie. I mean, of course, it's been overshadowed by the wild, unprecedented success of Barbie. But you know, I hope that people in Hollywood who make decisions like this are like, okay, so why was it that so many people went to see Oppenheimer? Well, Christopher Nolan, because he is a brilliant filmmaker. They gave him a lot of support, and he made the movie he wanted to make. You know, I think that has a lot to do with it. I don't think necessarily we're going to suddenly get a bunch of biopics about physicists from the 1940s now.
What, that Niels Bohr musical is going to be coming out anytime soon?
So, Stephen, what else were you going to suggest that we watch for the Atomic Age episode that we now will be doing?
I had a bunch of them. The first that came to mind was a movie called The Atomic Cafe. And it was a movie that came out, I think, in the late 80s. It was a documentary. It was a big hit on the art house circuit. And it was, I don't even think there was narration. It was composed purely of Atomic Age era 1940s and 50s documentary and propaganda footage. And it had all the requisite bits like duck and cover, you know, the cartoon with the turtle who, you know, pulls into his shell to avoid the atomic blast, and all the footage of kids hiding under their desks. And but also like the effect on pop culture, like, you know, the introduction of the bikini the bathing suit that was inspired by or named after Bikini Atoll, where a lot of the atomic tests were taking place, and some of the pop music of the time that made references to atomic bombs and so on. There was a gospel. So I had the soundtrack LP actually at home, but some of the songs were like "Jesus Hit You Like an Atom Bomb" was a gospel song, and then there's Slim Gaylor, the great kind of jazz hepcat, had a song called "Atomic Cocktail," you know, where he talks about, you know, the cocktail that will blast you out of this world kind of thing. And that's a great starting place for how this whole atomic mania was greeted by the public at large, because they knew something big was happening. And obviously, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the cat was out of the bag, as it were. And then that kind of took over public consciousness for a while, both as like, oh, yay, the atomic bomb made America number one, and oh no, the H-bomb is going to destroy us all. Mm. And so there was went quickly from euphoria to utter, desperation, I guess. And then there was the films that reflect kind of the horrors of nuclear warfare. I mean, amazingly, two of the most powerful ones are animated films. There's the British When the Wind Blows, and then there's a Japanese film called Grave of the Fireflies, about two children in Japan in the aftermath of the atomic bomb blast, which is utterly heartbreaking. So those are some of the films I was thinking about. And there's stuff that we may not have get to, but there was a British film called Threads about a community after a nuclear blast. And also The Day After, which was a TV movie, which I haven't seen since it aired. I remember it being pretty chilling. Threads is routinely described as the better movie, certainly dramatically. But The Day After was kind of a sensation.
I remember watching it, certainly. I mean, it was one of those TV movies that superseded the sort of any kind of feeling that, oh, this isn't quite up to snuff because it's a television movie.
Right.
It had real, everyone should be watching this because this feels like this could be what happens should the bomb, go off. You're right. I haven't watched it since the 80s either. It made a big impression on my young mind, though, I can tell you that much.
Yeah, some of the images from the film are still kind of lurking in the back of my mind. I seem to recall people like trying to evacuate, being turned to dust in their cars kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm over-remembering that scene.
Or it's a scene from the Terminator 2.
Oh, that could be. I could be conflating those futuristic nightmares from T2 with The Day After. That's very possible. And we're back for our final segment on Lends Me Your Ears, and it's the final Lends Me Your Ears, at least for the foreseeable future, as we said. Never say never again, as a wise alternate universe James Bond once told us. Anyway, today our
James Bond episode was pretty great, by the way.
Yes, that is true.
Anyone who's listening to this and hasn't gone back to listen to our James Bond episode really needs to go and do that.
That is a classic. And we've done more than one.
We brought up Bond as often as we could fit him in, but we did dedicate an entire episode to him, too.
Being allowed to stay up to watch Thunderball and the ABC Sunday Night Movie is certainly one of my formative movie experiences as a child. So love or hate James Bond, and many people do hate the character, hate the series, hate the author. For me, that was certainly my introduction to the world of kind of bigger adult cinema, as it were. So, mm-hmm. so I can't count it out by a long shot.
Yeah, but, me neither.
But yeah, I mean, obviously, we watch a lot of movies for this program to find the six or more films, often more, usually more. Films that we would watch for a given topic every week. And then I would watch about 10 other films because I had stacks of DVDs that are sitting by next to the TV set and a bunch of things that DVR'd off Turner Classic Movies and elsewhere. So it's a bit of an addiction, I'm sure, if I want to get clinical about it. But there are more harmful ones out there. And this is... certainly one that I consider fairly elucidating and definitely entertaining. And something I've liked to do over the years, although COVID kind of put a crimp in going away to see movies, which is something I do on a regular basis, but also I used to go to a classic film event that took place in Syracuse, New York every year. I think I talked about it on the show before, but it was called Cinefest. And then in year 35, about a decade or so ago, they called it quits for various different reasons. The founder of the festival had passed away, and they felt they'd run through the kind of the films that their membership had been able to dig out of personal collections and archives and so on. And it was just a lot of work for them to pull together. But a festival that's been going on for 20 years and actually celebrated its 20th anniversary this summer is Capital Fest in the same neck of the woods. It's in Rome, New York, every August. And apart from, you know, some COVID-related hiatuses, they've been able to keep it going since 2003. And it's named after the Capitol Theater, which is a now restored movie palace in downtown Rome, which is kind of part of the Utica area. It's west of Albany in upstate New York. Utica, I think, is the main center. And Rome is kind of like a suburban community, but it's got a main street and a downtown of sorts. And they have this old movie palace that they managed to preserve, unlike Halifax, where we just tear them down and turn them into rock climbing gyms or condos or whatever, or TV studios. So, but they've actually saved it and turned it into a cultural center. They do live music there as well, and they show films. And they also have they've also opened up like a smaller rep house cinema for their digital projection, of sort of more current indie movies and sort of second run theatrical films. And so every year they pick like a star who's like their star of the festival. They don't just show films by that person, but they kind of examine their career by finding the films by that person that may not have been as well known or don't get shown as much, or because of copyright infringements or restrictions, can't be shown on TV or TCM or, on home video or whatever. So this year it was Mary Astor was their star. And of course, most people know her from playing the femme fatale in the Maltese Falcon, where she's the Humphrey Bogart, Sam Spade basically sends her up the river for killing his partner. And that there's that great last shot where she gets into that Art Deco elevator and just slowly descends into hell, basically, with the light, the shadow shining up on her face and all that kind of thing. But she had a long, long career going back to when she was a teenager, like 14 or 15, she was appearing in movies, playing much older characters. So she was kind of preternaturally mature, I guess, and was, playing romantic leads at a very early age in silent films. And then, had a career in early talkies. And then it was slightly derailed when she had a scandal involving a divorce and a messy child custody battle. And then somehow her diary, which detailed an affair she had with George S. Kaufman in graphic detail, became public. So there are stories that some of that stuff is completely fictitious, made up by the yellow rag journalistic papers. I don't know how much of that is true, but amazingly, she was able to recover and had this whole other career after the dust had settled from this horrible marriage collapse and child custody battle. So, she was a beautiful, beautiful woman. The silent film, she's very expressive. And I got to see some films she made in rural Maine as a teenager. She wasn't a star yet, and she got hired by a producer who was making these films in bucolic woodland towns and forests that were kind of promoting the logging industry.
Wow.
they showed two of them, and they were very entertaining. They were under an hour. And
how are they projected? Are they projected from film?
On film for the most part. There were a couple of things they showed that were from digital because they've only just been preserved and there weren't film prints available. But I'd say 90% of what we saw was actually projected on film, 35 millimeter and 16 millimeter. So the Mary Astor films were very interesting. I got to see her in an amazing screwball comedy. Now I got to look this up because I saw so many films. I can't remember all the names of them. But it was called Reckless Living. No, that wasn't it. It's called No Time to Marry was the name of the film.
No Time to Marry.
No Time to Marry.
Nice.
From 1938. It's a Columbia film. Now, a lot of...
The lesser-known Bond movie, No Time to Marry.
No Time to Marry. Directed by Harry Lachman, a journeyman director. Columbia was kind of like... I mean, it's considered one of the major studios, but it was kind of on the lower end of the scale. And a lot of those films just don't show up anywhere on home video. There's no sort of Columbia outlet for their film catalog. Like, for example, Turner Classic Movies, they have complete access or mostly complete access to the MGM catalog, the Warner Brothers catalog, RKO, and then some affiliated properties, maybe some United Artists things and that kind of thing. But anything else they have to license and pay extra money for, they don't have it in their libraries. So things from Paramount and Universal and Columbia, you know, from those studios, aside from some of the bigger titles with people like, say, Marlene Dietrich or the Universal horror movies with Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi, I mean, that stuff's well known and it's widely available. But that's just the tip of the iceberg for what these studios were putting out. So, I mean, this was it's a screwball comedy. It's set in the world of kind of wacky newspaper reporters, kind of like His Girl Friday. And Mary Astor and Richard Arlen are reporters who keep having their marriage interrupted by breaking news that they have to go and cover. And they can't get there. And the reporters are taking bets on whether or not the marriage will actually happen. And finally, it's Christmas Eve. They figure, we'll get married on Christmas Eve. Nothing ever happens at Christmas. You know, everything will be fine. And then just all hell breaks loose. And so they're going off chasing a story about an heiress that has gone missing. They don't know if she's eloped or been kidnapped or whatever. And then one of them gets assigned to find a couple of goats for their publisher's son's Christmas present. Anyway, it's just bonkers. And it's a Christmas movie, which I'd never heard of. I thought this would be a classic if it was aired on TCM every Christmas or wherever it ever came out on home video or whatever. But it sat on the vaults and nobody's really seen it since 1538, as far as I can tell. So, that's the kind of stuff we're watching. But also silent films with live music and so on. And that's really, that's how I like to spend my summer vacation.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun to me.
Yes.
And especially seeing things that you can't find, you know, generally. And that's, I mean, you know, we could go on and on. We're running out of time. We could go on and on
very talking rapidly
about the you know, the accessibility of certain films. And we've always tried to see things that are generally available. So occasionally we're, you know, digging into your vault or my vault for stuff on physical media that isn't available on any streaming service or isn't rentable. You know, and then of course, if you have a VPN, then sometimes you can find things elsewhere in the world. It's the challenge is still out there. And anyone listening, I gotta say, put a shout out for physical media. My trip to Toronto just now, I visited Babe Lore Video and got myself a stack of new Blu-rays and DVDs, and I was thrilled about that. So,
and on my way home from Rome, I drove down. It's not easy to fly there, and on the way back, stopped at many of the Bull Moose record stores, which populate many towns in New England, mostly through Maine and New Hampshire. And they are a terrific resource. I would recommend just going to Maine and visiting all the Bull Moose record stores for used music, new music as well, new records and CDs, but also used records and also a new and used DVDs and Blu-rays. And I came home with a little mini stack of things that I'm going to enjoy in the coming months. And it was just so great to be in a store that has not just some physical media, but a lot of it. And thank goodness there's still stores like that out there.
Yeah, for sure. Well, are we coming to the end? I can't even see the time.
We are very close. I think it's time to wrap it up and say our final goodbyes.
Well, shall we just do that then?
We'll do that. We'll take a quick break and come back for our final summation. And that wraps up this episode of Lends Me Your Ears, and for now, the final episode of Lends Me Your Ears for the time being, as Karsten and I go off to do different things. It's been a real pleasure to be doing the show for the past several years and to hopefully bring some new movie watching ideas to you. And I hope you enjoyed the conversation about movies from all over the world and from all moments in time. And it's certainly been our pleasure to track these things down, watch them, and discuss them with each other and share them with you. My name is Stephen Cook, and you can find me online. I'm on Twitter or X. And I'm glad we're ending before we have to deal with that every week. But for now, I'm at @NS_SCOOKE.
And I'm also on that platform named after my blog, which I would encourage people to continue to read if you get a chance. You want to keep hearing my voice anyway, virtually. Flaw in the Iris is what it's called. It's on halifaxbloggers.ca.
And of course, many thanks to CKU for the use of their facilities every week to put this show together, to record the voice track and to air us every other Tuesday at 5 p.m. I imagine they will probably be having the show in reruns for a while, maybe at strange hours of the morning, you never know. And of course, the Village Soundcast Network for being the impetus to get this show up and running and up on podcast platforms where you can still find the past episodes for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, thank you, Jason Michael McIsaac, for all you've done. You inspired us to do this show way back in 2015 and have always been there. We appreciate it.
Lends Me Your Ears is hosted by Stephen Cook and Karsten Knox and is produced in Halifax, Nova Scotia at Village Sound for the Village Soundcast Network. All music courtesy of Gypsophilia. Send feedback to lendsmeyourearspodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening.
This was a Village Soundcast Network original production.